and I love it. I love my job. I love what I do. I love speaking to people. It's kind of like something I'm good at. It's my superpower, but I also need time for myself, and I'm too hyper to meditate. So running for me has become kind of a meditation where nobody can reach me. It's just me and my thoughts, good or bad, right? And then you kind of have to deal with them. I had to kind of fend for myself. I mean, I had to like hustle on the street. I was honestly a little kid. But then I saw my mom. She pulled herself out of it. It's such an inspiration, but she worked her ass off to do it. And that just kind of like taught me at an early age, you know, that you can overcome, that you can persevere. My uncle, he always said this to me, there's just some people who are born with kind of the happy gene. And it kind of always stuck with me. And it's true. And I think there's some people who are just naturally more enthusiastic, more optimistic, more kind of hopeful in the way that they look at the world. My experience is people, of course, like good decisions, good news. They hate bad decisions or bad news. But what's even worse is uncertainty or no decision, because it just stops everything. Or people just swirl, they make up their own story. I always say, tell my team and my leaders, in the absence of information, when you don't have information, when your team doesn't have information, they will make up stories in their own head. Leadership is a key requirement. Waiting for the perfect situation, forget it. It's not gonna happen. If it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, it usually means that we're heading in a direction that's new or groundbreaking that hasn't been done before.
I'm curious, how do you define success?
That's a good question.
And welcome to Everyday Leadership, a podcast where you get to listen and learn how to lead yourself personally and professionally through the lessons and life experiences my guests share, in the hope that it challenges and inspires you to lead yourself from the inside out and not the outside in.
Welcome to Everyday Leadership, the podcast where we get the pleasure of delving behind the titles of amazing people to explore the truth behind what it means to, I guess, lead with intention, with authenticity, with impact. And today I have an amazing guest I'm looking forward to speaking to. I have Robin Daniels, who is a business leader, a writer, a speaker, an athlete, I'm going to call him that, who's helped scale some of the world's most iconic like tech companies, Salesforce, LinkedIn, Bucks, WeWork, and played like multiple IPOs. He's led global teams across US, Europe, and now he's a chief business and product officer at Zensai. And he's someone who, I've already felt it already, but I've seen it kind of written down that he's known for that infectious energy. And he's someone who's amazing at building epic teams. And he kind of brings like decades of growth and grit and that global leadership to the table. So I am looking forward to unpacking your story today. Robin, thank you for being on Everyday Leadership Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Shobha. It's great to be here. That's a great introduction. I've always wanted to be called an athlete. That you just made my day.
Listen, when you run the marathons, you run. You are on that level. So
I don't see myself. To me, I use it as a coping mechanism. I'm not even kidding, because my days are so busy with work and with talking to people, and I love it. I love my job. I love what I do. I love speaking to people. Is kind of like something I'm good at. It's my superpower, but I also need time for myself. And I'm too hyper to meditate. So running for me has become kind of a meditation where nobody can reach me. It's just me and my thoughts, good or bad, right? And then you kind of have to deal with them. And I think a run is kind of always hard. The first couple of miles always suck, you know, and then you get into a flow, kind of like life in many ways, right? You got to get started. The first steps into any new venture kind of like always suck. But once you get into that flow, you kind of like feel like, okay, this is going well, right? So, but the fact that you're calling me an athlete, that just made my day.
No, you really are. And to be fair, the way you describe running is exactly why I started it myself as well, because I can't meditate because my brain's always going. But two, I also hated running. I never understood. I was like, why are people just running for no reason? Unless it's a football on my feet. It made no sense. So I took it up as a challenge to be like, actually, let me just see if I can overcome this fear, and became that safe place where early mornings, no one around me, just me and my thoughts. And it was just, hey, it was amazing. Got so much clarity in the spaces. That's why I just became my thing.
Totally. I post about it quite a lot and talk about it a decent amount. And people think I've been a runner my whole life. No, actually, I did my first half marathon, I think when I was 32. And then it really sucked. Yeah, I was living in California. I was doing it, I did it in the mountains. And then I'm like, I'm going to sign up for a marathon, which I then did my first one at 35. And it really sucked. But it was also joyful in the sense that you achieve something. Like and I just thought to myself at the end, this is such a great metaphor for life in some way that you can overcome anything that you set your mind to. I mean, building a business is hard. Being a leader is hard. Going through life is hard. And the point for me of a marathon, why I now committed to doing one a year, is just to remind myself more than anything that I can get through life, that I can get through this thing, that don't just give up in the face of, you know, hardship or tough situations, because you know it's all temporary. There's another side of that. It's kind of finish a marathon. When you're like in mile 10 out of 26, you feel like, God, is this ever going to end, right? And then you get to the end and you're like, okay, you know? And life is a lot like that, I feel. It's just, to me, it's just a perfect metaphor for life, business, growth, even parenting, you know? It's like all these things.
Was a lot of that shaped from a younger you, a childhood you, when you were still in Denmark, like then in your early, you know, call it your early teens, when you were like 10, 11, 12? Was that where some of that mentality of if you can get through things, is that where it came from?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I grew up, I was born and raised in Denmark to two hippie parents, and they were loving in their own way, but quite dysfunctional. And then they got divorced when I was probably around 6 or 7. You know, that a divorce is never just like overnight. It takes a while. So it was about that age. I ended up living with my mother and my two brothers. And then my mother had a nervous breakdown in the early 80s. And she was kind of out of it for many years where she couldn't really cope. And then I had to kind of fend for myself. I mean, I had to like hustle on the street. I was honestly a little kid. And the way I survived was I would go around picking up bottles on the street that I would find and return them to the store so I could get some money in return, so I could get some food and so on. It sounds for Denmark, people think of Denmark as like this utopian society. And like, yeah, I mean, it's very nice, but there's still poverty, you know? So, and we were, I would say, very poor and struggling. But then I saw my mom, she pulled herself out of it, you know, this kind of nervous breakdown that she had. And she's been very open about it. She's written about it and so on. So it's not like it's a secret or anything. She pulled her way out of it, built her own business, and really became, I would say, not hugely successful, but moderately successful enough to support her family and live her dreams, which I think is really great. And such an inspiration. But she worked her ass off to do it. And that just kind of like taught me at an early age, you know, that you can overcome, that you can persevere. I would say ethic of working hard. She really worked hard to support her three boys and create a life that she thought was inspiring and gave her pleasure and joy and kind of building something for the future. And so I learned a lot from that, you know, and that's why now I would say the main thing that I kind of really care about is how do I pass that feeling on that everybody can do more than they actually think that they're capable of? Because I think so many people put the very small limits on their ability, either through their thinking or what they think they can achieve. But then also just like this notion that you can overcome and do way more than you think in a way that gives you freedom. What I'm chasing mostly is the joy and freedom. It's like, I'm not chasing the money or the size of my team and all that stuff. I mean, of course I want to be successful. I want to do well. That's not exclusive of any of that. But more than anything, just being able to have joy and freedom in my life is kind of ultimately what I'm going for. And I can see that's honestly what most people are chasing. And so trying to give that on, pass it on, is something that I've really kind of stuck with me. It's what I learned from my parents. It's deeply ingrained in me, and I'm trying to pass it on in my own way here in the future.
That's a very powerful lesson that your parents have taught you. And a powerful mindset. And part of what I see when I, in these kind of conversations, well, sometimes people go through experiences like you just described right now. And rather than looking at it at the positives and the lessons learned, you can stay stuck in what's actually happened, or you can stay stuck in the woe is me. And it sounds very much like you were in a situation, you had to fend for yourself, your mom got better, you learned from her, and then you elevated to the next level. What was that allowed you to be able to have that mentality of, I want to say, looking at things from a very positive-esque kind of perspective to then use your experiences as fuel to drive you forward?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think certainly it's a confluence of a lot of experiences. Like the fact of growing up in poverty, I think you see that in a lot of people who grow up that way. They have a different mindset around different set of positive values. They're optimistic in a different way when you had to fight for everything. This idea of gratitude, whenever I have, even today, you know, I fly a lot in my work and in my private life. And even every time I fly and I'm sitting there and coach and I'm like, I'm so grateful that I have this opportunity to fly, just like that I've created this world and life for myself. And just this idea of gratitude being part of your life, that it's so ingrained in everything that you do. You're grateful for your food, your life, where you live, the friendships that you have. But I think it came very early because I had to fight for a lot of this. It wasn't natural to me. When I was 11 years old, my mother, she got remarried to somebody, and we ended up moving to Atlanta, Georgia from Denmark for a year. And you know, that was a huge cultural shock. And I suddenly had to learn how to like make my own way in an environment that was very different, in a culture that was very different. I think, Shoba, you told me you moved from Nigeria when you were 11, right? Same age. Huge culture shock of probably coming from Nigeria to London, right? Having to fend for yourself, didn't know people, right? Like, it was huge culture shock for me as well. And I was like, but I just had that attitude of like, I'm going to make the best of it. I'm going to try to be open and make friends and so on. I don't think I thought of it consciously, honest, if I'm honest about it at that point in time, right? But it was just kind of like part of who I am. So I think, so it's a long answer of saying, I think it's a confluence of all of these different experiences. The other thing I would say, my uncle, he always said this to me, and he lives in Boston. He has a great family and we're very close. He said, there's just some people who are born with kind of the happy gene. And it kind of always stuck with me. And it's true. And I think there's some people who are just naturally more enthusiastic, more optimistic, more kind of hopeful in the way that they look at the world versus some people. There's some people in my life who are certainly not that way. And I've kind of looked at their life and like, but you have everything and you're still not that way. What is it that's missing? And I think there's something about that happy gene. I can't prove it, but it just resonates with me because I'm like, I'm just naturally always quite optimistic and happy and hopeful for the future. I'm always a glass half full kind of person versus a glass half empty. It's also meant that the companies I've tried to work for in my career and the leaders I've tried to work for and align myself with have very much had that DNA as well. When I think about Salesforce and Mark Benioff or Box and Aaron Levy or LinkedIn and Jeff Wiener, or even WeWork and Adam Newman, they were all like dreamers and believed and hoped for a better world. And they thought that with their magic, they could conjure up that better world themselves, of course, with great people around them. And I've always been attracted to that versus the kind of leaders who think everything is doom and gloom and the future is screwed. And we're all kind of like, and I've been around some of those leaders too. And it's really tough, I find. I have a hard time being around kind of these energy drainers versus the energy givers, you know?
Which I can understand. That's a question that's thinking in my head. It's like, how do you, when you're in an environment where your values or your personalities clash, how do you as a leader react to that, to your team or your peers at that point in time? And then how do you ensure that you don't pass on that energy to your team that you're actually leading as well? Because you're managing two different personalities.
So it's something I think about a lot. I think a lot about the way I show up for my team, for my one-on-ones, for the company. I'm very mindful of the fact that how I show up is 100% in my control. And it doesn't mean it's always easy, I don't think. And I think we all have our struggles, you know. You could have a bad morning. You could be sick. Like you might not be feeling well. You might have had a bad meeting with your board, or your kid is being a jerk to you in the morning, or there's all these things that can happen all the time. But it doesn't change the fact, if you ask me, that the way you show up every single day is 100% in your control. If it was easy, everybody would show up perfectly every day. So it's not easy. And I think there's many times where you can have good excuses for showing up in a less than ideal way, but it doesn't change the fact, if you ask me, that the way you show up every day is in your control. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, when you're around those different people, the way you show up to them, you also have to modify and modulate based on how they see the world. One of the things I think I failed at when I was early in my career is this art of communication. I think, you know, about two and a half years ago, I was in my son's school. He was a senior in high school, and they had these things called life days. And they invited parents in from various industries to come teach their students, the students and the class, around certain life skills. That's why they were called life days, that we thought as parents or teachers were important when they exited school. And I came in and I gave a 1.5 hour course / lesson on communication skills, because I think, to me, that's the most important thing that will either make or break you as you go out into the real world. Well, that's in your work life. Of course, I was talking more about work, but even in your private life and personal life, the way you communicate with your kids or spouse and partner and so on. And coming back to it, I mean, I think when I didn't quite get that when I was earlier in my career, and I failed when I was not able to communicate succinctly or in a worldview that matched up with the person I was communicating with. As I've gotten older, and it's not perfect all the time, it's hard to do, but knowing that communication has to be modulated to the people that you're speaking to. When I'm speaking to, say, a head of product versus a chief financial officer versus a CEO versus a board member versus somebody who might work for me versus somebody who's hyper creative, maybe a creative director, they all see the world very differently. And if I go in and have a creative conversation with the CFO, he's going to go crazy, right? He's going to be like, I need the numbers, I need to know this, and all that. And vice versa, if I go into a creative person and have just a financial-based discussion on, hey, this creative you're working on, what's going to be the financial outcome of that? So the way you talk to people and the way I think you communicate with them matters more than anything. And I think it's going to even matter more in this age of AI that we're going into. And so I failed every time. I haven't been able to do that well. I feel like people haven't taken the action that I wanted, or they haven't, you know, I haven't been able to get people along with me for the ride. But when I've been able to communicate well and get people to understand why this matters, that's usually when you can actually move the needle in very significant ways. And it comes from one clear thing, that's clarity. The thing I always start with, Shopa, is everything starts with clarity. Like, if you want to achieve great things, if you want to do great work, if you want to have joy at work, because if you lack clarity, it leads to misunderstanding, it leads to toxic work environment. It leads to political work environments that people always hate. So, but if you have clarity, most of that goes away. It's usually lack of clarity that breeds all these things.
But we're operating in a world that seems less and less clear and more chaotic, especially with, like I said, AI adding another level of layer onto that as well. Different generation workforces, geopolitical movements kind of happening. So everywhere you look, it's like everything that was a firm foundation for so many people, it's changing or rocking. So how do you bring clarity in chaos?
It's a great question. And it's something you have to deal with every day. The job of a leader is to make decisions, even when you don't have perfect information. And a lot of times you don't, right? You don't have the So my experience is people, of course, like good decisions, good news. They hate bad decisions or bad news. But what's even worse is uncertainty or no decision, because it just stops everything. Or people just swirl. They make up their own story. I always tell my team and my leaders, in the absence of information, when you don't have information, when your team doesn't have information, they will make up stories in their own head. So it's our job to communicate as much as you can with as much certainty as we can, even when it's not always perfect. The worst you can have is just let people swirl. It just creates very negative emotions. And a lot of times people get so frustrated, they'll either burn out or they'll leave. And so to your question, how do you do that in an environment that's changing super fast, that's uncertain with AI, political tension, inflation, all this stuff happening? That's the job of leaders. That's why it's hard. So when I hear leaders talk about it's so hard, I can't make it. Yeah, suck it up. That's the job of leaders, to make decisions when it's hard. You won't always have perfect information. You won't always have the perfect answer, and that's okay. Your job is to have the courage to put out something and say something that at least moves people forward. The worst is if they're just stuck. So try to move forward, even if it's, let's say it's 80% of that, the right direction, or even 60%, it's better than just being stuck, right? The idea that you have to have the perfect answer and the perfect scenario, strategy every single time, it's an illusion. I don't know if that even exists, because who's going to verify that it's the perfect thing to do? Your job as a leader is to make the hard calls. So there's a key thing that I've been really on my mind a lot lately. Is that I feel like sometimes when I look at companies, because I've spent a lot of my time advising CEOs and working with companies all across the world, we lack courage. Courage is a key ingredient in being a leader and being ahead of the game, is that you have to have the courage to, of course, hopefully be right and set the tone for the future, but also be wrong. It's okay if you don't get it right all the time, if you don't say the perfect thing all the time. but you have to move ahead. You can't sit still. You can't just stop the machine. And I see it's that when the leader lacks that courage, it starts seeping through to various members of the team. I see it actually in some people that I've led over the last couple of years. They come, hey, can I do this? Or what do you think I should do here? I want to reach out to this person. Can I do that? I'm like, why are you asking me? Just go do it. You know, it's like, just go for it. Like, I think there's you got to have a little bit of, especially if you want to rise in the ranks and you want to like create a life of leadership for yourself where you become a senior person that actually is guiding teams and leading teams. Leadership is a key requirement. Waiting for the perfect situation, forget it. It's not going to happen.
Yesterday I was having this conversation around the fact that it's only recently I realized how much courage is a skill. And it's never ever talked about in that way, but it is, because to your point, you're not always going to have all the information. You definitely can't be perfect. And actually having the courage to move in a particular direction, even when you get things wrong, you still get data. And people are more likely to forgive you when you be like, we're heading this direction, we want to get it right, but at least we're going to try, than when you're just dithering, because to your point, they'll make up their own stories. But even more importantly, something around you also being able to model imperfection. We talk a lot about psychological safety, but actually, how do we demonstrate that in the way that we act? So I love what you were saying around, actually, you're not going to be perfect, but make a decision, have that clarity, move forward in one particular way. And it got me thinking around how many leaders struggle with that, because they're so used to wearing their leadership, for want of a better word, as a mask, and it's all a performance. And it got me thinking around, I know you speak a lot about authenticity, and I'm curious, like, how has your, I'm going to call it your relationship authenticity, increased over the years? How's that helped you become a better leader in every single area of your life, personally and professionally, as opposed to when you think about it from when you first started?
Like you said, I think you say, well, it's something you can learn and you can practice over time. It doesn't come naturally. Even today, I think it's hard, because there is this, it's a couple of factors that play against it. One, there's like the imposter syndrome that I think that many of us carry, like, well, what am I doing in this room, right? I'm surrounded by all these smart people. So that's there. Then there's the second thing is this, like you said, this mask, and you feel like you have to be perfect all the time, right? But I think what you learn, and what you learn obviously for a lot of people later in life, is that it's okay not being perfect. This is something that you usually go through in your 20s, 30s, maybe 40s. But once you get to be a little bit more experienced, you realize nobody's perfect and nobody has all the answers. And everyone's sitting with these feelings of imperfection, imposter syndrome, not knowing exactly what to say, but they're all kind of changing. But of course, as you get more experienced and more comfortable with it, you can start leaning into that discomfort, but you can also train it. So one of the things, for example, I tell my teams, you know, especially the marketing teams that I've led over the last couple of years, is to really lean into this discomfort. So I always say, okay, there's three levels that we operate on. It's true of any company and it's true of any team, whether it's a product team, sales team, marketing team, and so on. You can do tactical things, strategic things, or epic things. And the way I would define epic things is you either find something that's so broken and you do it 10 times better, or you do something that's never been done before. But the reason epic things are so hard for most individuals or teams is because there's no roadmap to guide you. When you're operating in the tactical and strategic realm of planning and doing things, you've got some data, maybe a few unknowns, but a lot of data to guide you. Like, if we do this, then we can expect this kind of outcome. Maybe not perfectly, but when you're operating in the epic realm of things, the exponential realm of things, there's really no roadmap, because if there was, people would probably have done it already. So you're by nature stepping into something unknown. And so I've trained my teams over the last couple of years, decades, I would even say, to lean into the discomfort that comes from not having all the answers. So I tell them, when you come present an idea to me, or we talk about a certain topic, if it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, it usually means that we're heading in a direction that's new or groundbreaking that hasn't been done before. If I have that voice in my head that goes, can we do this? Should we do this? This is stupid. Oh, well, this seems a little risky. Is it dangerous? All these kind of inner voices that we oftentimes had that end up modulating ourselves, I think, in some ways, or shutting down these ideas. These are good. These are good signs that actually you're stepping into something in a growth path. And one of two things will happen. Either you lean into that and you do it and you succeed massively, or you lean into it and you do it and it fails, but then you still learn. There's really no failure, right? So as long as you have that mindset, either you win or you learn. There's no win or fail. You win or you learn. That's a whole different mindset. Because I can guarantee one of two things will happen if you lean into kind of these epic things. If it works out, it will change the outcome for the business that you're working for tremendously, and they will thank you forever. And by nature of that, the second thing that happens is it'll change the trajectory of your career and your life forever, because suddenly you become known to have done this thing. Something that happened to me early in my career when I was at Salesforce, I leaned into this and I created so much momentum around this role that I had where I was leading this product called Chatter. And I started making a name for myself in the industry. And then companies started coming and finding me. Boxton came and headhunted me from Salesforce. And since Salesforce, I've never had to look for a job, and I feel blessed, but it's also because I dared to step in to do something that was a little bit brave and different and epic. And I say this to everybody, when you're like starting out your career or you're in the middle of your career, at some point you have to step into this if you really want to see it take off and do something. But it's hard. I mean, and a lot of things, you know, that you end up trying to do will probably fail as well. And that's okay, because that's not really failure. You just learn from it, which is a beautiful thing.
When I think about you talking about being epic, taking that to your career, because at 21, you booked a ticket to San Francisco, no contacts, no leads, no job, nowhere to stay. And that became the start of your career, which has then led to some of those name brands. And I'm curious, when you stepped into that epic journey for you at 21, what did you think was going to happen? And are you living up to that expectation now?
It's a great question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that question. I would say yes and no. Yes, it became an adventure in a way that far exceeded any expectations that I had. I met my wife in the US. I worked at some epic companies. I think I had like some great outcomes as well. I've made friendships that will last me a lifetime. And I've had so many moments of joy that I didn't even anticipate. But no, in the sense, because I actually thought when I moved over there, one of my dreams was to really start my own company. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I never really got that to happen. You know, I ended up starting a company in 2006. I ran it for about a year and a half, kind of first as a side hustle. Then I leaned into it more and we raised a little bit of like pre-seed funding to do it, but it failed. And then I kind of went back and it was just kind of like not going that well. And then when Salesforce reached out to me and offered me a position there or asked me if I wanted to come interview with them, I said yes, and ended up going to Salesforce. And since then, you know, I haven't really gone back to the entrepreneurial thing. So in some ways, it's not like I regret the career. I've had a great career, I think, in many ways. Lots of failures in there too. I mean, WeWork was a spectacular crash, obviously, and other companies have not done as well as I'd hope. So in many ways, yeah, it's exceeded it. But I came over there. I just had a dream, basically, that I wanted to be part of something special. I love technology because I love the way technology can change and impact the way that we work or we live. And the greatest companies and the greatest technologies, they kind of impact the way you work and live, not just either or. And I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be part of making that happen. I feel like when I look back on my resume and the companies I work for, I've been part of some of those movements. You know, I mean, it's Salesforce is an integrated part of how society operates today. So is LinkedIn. I can't imagine a world without LinkedIn. Like, they're still the way that we kind of connect and communicate from a professional perspective. But there's still a little itch in me that has a little bit of that entrepreneurial. But so it's funny, actually, now that I'm at Sensei and I am the chief business officer, I run product, I run marketing and go to market, I get to kind of be the entrepreneur. Because, you know, when I came in, we were known as being a learning platform company. We just had one product, a learning platform. Now we're selling three products that make up what we call the human success platform, a learning platform, an employee engagement platform, a performance management platform. And together we call that the human success platform, with the vision that we want this to be the catalyst for people to become the best that they can be every day, even change the name of the company. So in some ways, this has become my baby, even though I didn't start the company, just to be clear, right? And so I don't know if that itch is as big as it used to be when I first moved over there, because I feel like I am now, through me being a leader and having vision, conceiving of this company as we go along.
I always say there's two types of founders, for want of a better word. You have entrepreneurs, who is the typical, and intrapreneurs.
Yeah.
I think a lot of when I look at your career, you've been that entrepreneur, because there were a number of things you've done in some of those other spaces. You've, like you said, there were epic stuff. So you introduced new things into their ecosystem, which are still being used going forward. So you, like, working in those ecosystems, you're living your dream, just looks different, but you're actually an entrepreneur.
True. That's true. I've never heard that term before, but I like it. I think I'm going to start using it. When I joined a company in 2014 in Palo Alto in California as chief marketing officer, I was the first business hire. There was like 8 engineers, and then I was hired as the first business hire. And they lovingly called me a near founder, because I was like more or less a founding leader. I mean, I didn't create the product, but I was like the story, even changed the name of the company, changed the brand, the vision of what, and you know, a company is only half of it is product. You have, of course, have to have a great product. But really, if you can't take it to market, if you can't be creative about it, you're going to fail. Half of it's execution, if not more of it, right, in many ways. So it's the product. And I've always been good on the execution side, the storytelling side, the go-to-market side, and all that stuff. I'm not as technical as I used to be. I actually started my career somewhat as a programmer. You know, I was a self-taught programmer in the 90s. I started by building basic websites, and then I graduated into learning Java and JavaScript and kind of building some more advanced stuff. But I wouldn't say I was like naturally great at it. I was so curious. I wanted to learn enough so I could be a part of this. So the first job I had in Silicon Valley was actually as a developer. But my boss quickly saw, you're okay with this, but you're actually better with people. We should move you into something else. So
that's good that at least your boss saw that right
early on. I know. Thank you, Elise. She changed my life. But this is also why I write about this a lot and I talk about it a lot. Of course, you have to have the persistence and will and grit to succeed in life, for sure. But I'm also where I am because so many people along the way have seen something in me, believe in me, or invested in me, or pushed me in a certain direction so I could become the best version of myself. And I'm very passionate. I spend a lot of my time on coaching and mentoring the next generation of founders. So when I get outreach, for example, on LinkedIn from somebody who says, hey, you've had a great career, can I pick your brain for 30 minutes? Because I'd love to see how I can take my life in a different direction. I don't do all of those calls because I'm also quite busy, but I do quite a few of them because I would love to model the world that I want to live in. I want to live in a world where we believe in each other and invest in each other and pass it forward, you know, and we're not just kind of closing ourselves off more and more from this kind of generational divide energy that we need to have in the world.
Have you always been a people person, or have you always led with technology? I'm curious. Someone who's a developer back in the day who speaks about people the way that you do, I'm curious what was your view on it?
I think I've learned to become a people person. I mean, fairly early on. It's not like it was something that was completely alien to me, but I learned by modeling myself after great people. I'm a voracious reader, study of human psychology. I love studying people. And by being surrounded by great people, I've learned how to become a great people leader. I don't know if it was always natural to me. And I think I've learned over time. But it's interesting, actually. I think a lot of people, from my presence that I have online and the way I lead every day, they think I'm hyper extroverted. And of course, I can be because it's part of my job, and
that's,
I actually enjoy.
It comes across.
Right. Yeah. I enjoy it. I enjoy spending time with you, but I also really like spending time with myself. For example, after I go and give a keynote presentation at a conference, if it's like an hour long or half an hour, I'm pretty exhausted, and I'm like, I just need like a couple of hours to myself. I can't just go straight from that to like just talk to people. I just need to like decompress a little bit. So I would say if there's a spectrum, I'm probably more extrovert than introvert, but I think I'm actually a little bit in the middle, you know. I really enjoy time with myself so I can just kind of think about the deeper things that I need to kind of solve for in some ways. So I think you probably change over time. I think when I was younger, I think actually I was more extroverted, if I'm honest about it. I think as I've gotten older, I don't know if it's just because maybe by nature of the positions that I have, I spend a lot of my time, most of my day is just talking to people. And I like it. It's like I love being the guide and the strategist and the helper and the leader that is making people do epic things. But it also means when I come home, I'm exhausted. And my wife has become very good at just knowing, like, just give me some space when I walk in the door. She's not like all over me right away. I'm just like, I just need to decompress, for a little bit. I don't know how do you deal with it? I'm curious.
Honestly, it's exactly the same. And I think having amazing partners, having amazing wives makes a big difference, and it's not talked about enough. Like, my wife knows when it's like, is it one of those days? Because obviously she's working, doing what she's doing, and she wants to share. And there are days when I come in, I'm like, she's like, you want to talk or you want to just chill, like, spend some time? I'm like, good. And she just gives me that space, so she knows, and she can read, and we can have those kind of conversations. I can text and that kind of stuff. And having that as a support system has been huge. I always say that I can't imagine me doing what I'm doing right now without my wife being with me, being together for 20 plus years. So it adds a whole different element to that. So having that at home, I think it's huge.
It's funny, I'm not really a morning person, and it takes me a good like hour and a half to wake up. And my wife and I, we've been together for a long time, so she knows, right? Like, don't talk to me anymore. I'm like, you can talk to me, and I'm not unhappy. I just don't want to get into like a long conversation. I can say yes or no, of course, and not a long, but I'm not like gonna have a deep discussion. Like, I need a little time to just wake up. And so now in the US, I'm sharing an apartment with my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, and her husband as well. And we have a nice place, and we each have kind of like, it's kind of separated nicely. But in the morning, they're very much morning people. So they wake up and they're like, go, 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 chatting, chatting, chatting. And so about a month ago, I had to sit them down and say, hey, I just need you to know I'm not unhappy, and I'm not trying to be grumpy or anything, but I'm not really a morning person. So in the morning, I don't particularly love having conversations. And I just thought I had to say it because it was getting a little uncomfortable in the morning. They were like, they were just chatting to me and they're like, what are you doing today? How's your day? What are you up to? And I was like, I'm just. So again, one of those things, having the courage to have that conversation, it was a little uncomfortable if I'm honest about it. Having clarity, right? All the things you talk about, but even in your daily life, in your personal life, it's so important. Clarity, courage, all these things, right? Also, I would just have sat there, suffered in silence. I'm like, what good does that do anyone, right? They just think I'm grumpy and an asshole, and I'm just like sitting there suffering. Might as well just
When do you exercise then?
Oh yeah, I try to exercise every day. So I basically, when I add it all up, I exercise about 9 or 10 times a week. And of course, it's only 7 days a week, but it's because I run about 4 to 5 times a week. And then I also do kind of HIIT or strength training 4 to 5 times a week. So it kind of adds up, And of course, because I try to work different parts of my body. So when do I exercise? I'm not a morning person, so I don't really exercise in the morning. Running, of course, oftentimes has to be done in the morning, especially when you sign up for races, because that's when they are. But I much prefer working out, I would say, late afternoon or evening. But it depends. Like, doing a run too late in the evening is hard, because then I think it's very hard to fall asleep. I think you can do strength training or some HIIT exercises in the evening. So I try to do those earlier. I'm very mindful. I've become a little bit obsessed about how I sleep. So a few years ago, I really kind of burned out because wasn't sleeping well, and I've been kind of on a journey back. So I felt like, on the three markers of how your physical health is, how you exercise, what you eat, and how you sleep, I would say I've always been, at least the last 20 years, been fairly obsessed with trying to be in shape. Not always succeeded because life gets in the way, but fairly obsessed about it. So I'll probably rank myself fairly high in like the way I exercise. I try to do something at least every day, sometimes twice a day even, right? So I will rank myself high. Food-wise, what I eat, probably medium. I probably could cut down on some sugar and fat and maybe some junk food and so on. But I'm also human and I train a lot and so on. But by sleep, I was ranked as low. And I'm just like, I wasn't sleeping well. Too much travel, time zone differences. It really broke. So the last, I would say, 15 years, as my career has really been elevated, Salesforce and Box, and like as you become more senior, the stress levels also go up. Those are kind of very correlated, I think, because it doesn't nobody everybody thinks if I just get that title, if I just get promoted, it'll get easier. No, it never gets easier. It never gets easier. It always gets hard. It always gets hard. The rewards get bigger and some of the joy gets bigger, but it never gets easier. So take that out of you. So my stress levels have also gone up, and it started impacting my sleep. And then it really broke during COVID. So during COVID, my family and I, we ended up moving from California to Denmark because we wanted to try to live abroad, and Denmark had handled COVID, I think, fairly well in the whole pandemic and so on. So we thought, let's just go to a place where schools are open, society's open, and we wanted to live there at least for a year or two so my son could get a Danish passport as well. But what I hadn't anticipated was working for a company in California while I was in Denmark. The 9-hour time difference was really tough. My whole team was in California. The whole executive team was there. I was up till 2 or 3 a.m. every night. And you know how it is. If you have an intense meeting, and a lot of my meetings are intense, that ends at 2 a.m., you can't just go straight to bed. Your brain is – so you have to – so I was getting to like these unhealthy – I would have a glass of wine or whiskey to kind of like just – oh, no, it's chill. But then that affects your sleep too. So my sleep was really broken. And so I ended up really have been going on a journey for the last, I would say, 3-4 years to try to get my sleep back. That's why I have the Oura Ring, right? You know, I think you have it as well, to kind of guide me in the right direction. And it's been great. I mean, my sleep score now hovers usually between 75 to 85. Sometimes it's a little higher, but not often. You know, I still kind of have the monkey brain going where I'm thinking a lot about stuff that's happening, either has happened or is happening. But I'm trying to up those three markers, you know, physical health, what I eat, and how I sleep, try to raise them up, all of them, to be not always perfect, because I'm not a monk. I don't want to be like perfect and live like a monk, but at least be better. So actually, I'll tell you, I went to a sleep camp in Italy in 2022 to like learn how to sleep again and get my sleep back. And one of the things I said to him when I showed up at this sleep camp, it's basically a wellness retreat, but I call it a sleep camp because I think it sounds better. But I've read all the books about sleep. I've listened to podcasts. I read articles. So I know all the science. And I said to him, I need a sleep program. I need sleep guidance for a person who lives a dynamic life. I'm not a monk. I'm not trying to go to bed at the same time every day. I like going out with friends every now and then. I travel a lot. I'm in different time zones. I'm in different hotel beds. The science is always like, oh, you go to bed at the same time every day in a temperature controlled room that's fully dark and you eat the same food. And I'm like, that's just not my life. I'm not a monk. I'm not a monk. I have no desire. I don't want to live till I'm 100, but let's say I live the perfect life every day. I'm like, I want to live life to the fullest. I want to travel and eat and meet people and be out there and have experiences. So I need the sleep hacks for a dynamic life, is what I told them. And of course, a lot of that comes down to the mindset you have. So I've learned to be better here around the ritual that I have before I go to bed, the mindset that I have when I'm in bed. So, and you can do that anywhere. If you fly to New York or you fly to Tokyo, you can carry that with you. Because the idea, because when I first came to that sleep retreat, there was like a lot of like the sound healing and crystal stuff, and you have to have this kind of temperature. I'm like, it's just not realistic for how I live my life, you know? So life is imperfect and you have to make the best of it. It's kind of what I learned. So I'm trying to do that every day.
If you haven't already, can you please follow the podcast? It really helps us grow, and it tells the apps that it's a podcast worth listening to, which the fact that you're listening to means that it is, and other people need to know about it. In Apple Podcasts, if you click the three dots in the top right of your app, look for the follow button and click on it. And in Spotify, the follow button should be just below the show's artwork. Now let's get back into today's episode.
What are some of those routines or habits that you've learned to be able to do, especially when you have that monkey brain consistently going, you have a dynamic role and the right life that you live. And I'm sure a lot of people can actually relate to that as well as they get bigger and bigger and bigger as well. So what are things that you've learned to help you be able to work on your mindset and get that optimal mindset?
There's a couple of things. I had a coach a few years ago. I don't use him anymore. Not because he wasn't good. He was great, actually, but he taught me a lot of like the fundamentals. His name is Ed Lee. He was a British guy, but he was based in Denmark when I was living there. So we worked together. Great guy. And he taught me a lot of like the fundamentals of just like how to put systems in place, which I thought was one of the things I was lacking in my life a little bit. I was a little too chaotic, if I'm honest about it, around the things that I was doing. So he taught me some of the fundamentals there. But one of the things I do that is really helpful for me when I have so many ideas, which I end up having, I journal a lot on my phone, on my laptop, in a notebook. You know, I write a lot of things down. It really helps me because at least I get it out of my brain versus like it's sitting there percolating and so on. And so And I would highly encourage, I think it's a game changer. If you're out for a walk, if you're sitting in a meeting and you have an idea, bring up your phone, the notepad, and just write it down. Just like, and I even times, a lot of times, I just write down the most basic version of this idea so I can come back to it later. But at least it's now out of my brain and I can like, I'm not gonna forget. I'm not gonna stress that I'm gonna forget this idea. So journaling and writing things down is are super important. The other thing that's honestly been a game changer for me, and I've done this for over 10 years, is intermittent fasting. And I know it's not for everyone, doesn't work for everyone. For me, it's been a game changer. And the reason why, I think I've realized over the last, 10, 15 years that my superpower in many ways is my energy and enthusiasm, infectious kind of way I show up to people. And if I'm not out of my best and if my energy is low, I can't show up at being my best. If I'm tired, if so I'm like I don't eat before noon if I can avoid it, because it just like spikes my energy levels up and down. And even at lunchtime, I try to eat something that doesn't get me into this funk. Like I was at a event, I think it's about a year ago or so, and it's the last time I did it. It just reminded me of why I would do intermittent fasting and why I really have to be mindful of what I eat. I had this huge sandwich at lunch. And for the next 3 hours, I was just kind of useless. I was tired and lethargic. And I'm just like, what a fucking waste of like energy. Like here I am sitting in these important meetings and I just like feel like crap. And so I'm trying to be very mindful. So I'm speaking of habits, to me, eating the what I put in my body, the fuel that I put in there, really can make a big difference in how I show up for other people. So I'm so mindful of how I try to show up for people or how I participate and the energy I give. That if I can't be at my best, I think it's just like I'm a shadow of myself. And so at lunch, I try to eat, some protein and some vegetables. That's usually the kind of the big thing. Even though, I mean, to be honest, if I could, if it wasn't an issue, I would eat like sandwiches, pizzas, burgers all the time because I love it. But it's just like, I just can't do it anymore. No, it's just not. So yeah, journaling, intermittent fasting. And then the final thing, I'm very mindful of who I spend time with, honestly. Like energy givers versus energy takers. Like when I look at my calendar and I see that I have a couple of meetings or I'm meeting with somebody who's like an energy taker, I kind of like steel my brain for it a little bit. I prepare myself mentally for it. And they always happen. It could be a partner, it could be a customer, it could be even an employee in the company, it could be somebody that you're trying to help out, right? But I'm just mindful I'm not spending all my time there because then my energy just kind of dips as well. And the way I didn't end up showing up for other people that really matter, whether it's my team or my peers or my family, it's just kind of ruined if I've just spent my day just having my energy sucked out of me, And so I'm very mindful of that. And that's not to say that everybody runs into those people all the time. It's just part of life. You can't avoid it. It's 100% guaranteed. And it's not to say that you have to be that perfect either every day. Like sometimes you'll probably be the energy taker too. But just I'm very mindful that I'm not spending my time just all day, every day with people who are just sucking my energy out of me. Then I'll, honestly, when that happens too often in a row, that's usually when I go, my life needs to change.
So do you intentionally schedule your days where you're like, oh, okay, that person might be an engine trainer. Okay, the next meeting afterwards, I need to make sure I have someone's actually restoring my energy, or I create some space so I can restore my energy myself. Do you plan it out that meticulously with your team to make sure that that's actually built out?
I try to. It's not always perfect, right? Life gets in the way and work is, I mean, like urgent things happen at work all the time. So I wouldn't say, but I would say I try to. I'm really mindful of this. I work hard to schedule my day in such a way that it ends up at the end of the day, I have an energy surplus versus an energy deficit. And it's not always, again, possible. There are certainly days when I go home and I'm drained, like most of us have experienced. But when that happens too often, again, like I said, that then I know it's time for a change. So I try to really be mindful. Like I want to make sure that most of the day is an energy surplus, the people I spend time with and the things I spend my focus on as much as I can. It's also like even now when I get asked to do meetings with people or introductions, I'll get, VCs or CEOs say, hey, you should go talk to this person. They'd love to pick your brain. I'm like, I really try to find out beforehand, honestly, what kind of person they are, because whether or not it's worth it. Because I learned also, I remember I had a really good friend of mine, a VC who I love, saying, hey, this CEO could really use some advice from you. Can you be an advisor to their company? And this again, when I was a little bit less experienced and I hadn't thought about it as much, And I just, of course, said yes to help out a friend. Of course, I'll do it. And then I ended up meeting this person. And this person was just kind of like such a downer and energy drain. We just didn't match, right? But now I kind of committed to helping this person out. And I'm just like, oh, what have I signed up for, you know? And I'm just like, oh, man. So every time a meeting, because I committed to like for a year doing like these quarterly check-ins and help them out. And every time a meeting came up on my calendar with this person, I'm just like, I was not excited by it. You know that feeling? Where like, I'm sure you probably have those where you're like, God, I'm about to talk to this person.
Thing that last minute cancellation, you're like, yes.
Exactly. Oh, exactly. That's such a great, then you know, oh, yes, for sure.
When I was doing some research into you, there's a statement that I read somewhere that really stood out to me. I think you said that you spent so much of your time trying to hide your background because you're a little embarrassed by it. But when you kind of changed that and you started to talk more about it, like you kind of connected. And you got me thinking that about, for example, at my company, one of the functions we talk about is we help leaders move from reaction to clarity by leaning into authenticity. But then I also recognize that not every exec in particular sees authenticity as a strength. So when you're in those rooms where performance and perception can easily dominate, how have you learned by leaning more into authenticity to be able to, I guess, hold your ground and bring your background into those spaces without losing influence? Because that's something I think a lot of people worry about.
It's a tough one, I would say, and it sounds flippant, and I don't mean it in a flippant way, but at some point I also just don't care anymore what people think about me. I mean, honestly, it's like if they're going to judge me for that, it's like, are these really people that I want to be associated with anyway? If they think less of me because of my background or where I've come from, these are not my kind of people anyway. I want to be surrounded by people who see the good in you, the opportunity in you, the thing that you've been to. And we all have our life stories. And some are sound on paper a little bit more rosy than others, but I think we all go through struggles, right? And if people can't see that the person I've become today has been because of what I've been through, are these really then the kind of people that I want to be around anyway? So again, I don't mean to sound flippant, but at some point I was like, don't care. But I used to hide it. You're absolutely right. I used to hide it a lot. Like this fact that I grew up in poverty, that I didn't really go to a fancy school, I have an advanced degree or all these things. I used to kind of like just try to change the subject, right? Like just like distraction, you know, strategy in some ways. And now I'm just like, I just lean into it. I'm like, I feel like even though I still want to do well in my life and I have a lot to prove internally, externally, I don't feel like I have as much to prove. I'm like, this is who I am. This is what you're going to get. If you can't accept that or you don't like it, I think that's more on you. And then maybe this is not a fit anyway. So I'm very open about it now, you know, but it didn't come easy. I would say it took me a while to like learn how to sit in that discomfort and just be like, and it really hit a peak for me, this kind of discomfort, when I was at LinkedIn actually. And to their credit, LinkedIn, I mean, they hired some of the smartest, most amazing people that I'd ever seen in my life. Most of them came from like McKinsey, BCG, Bain, you know, they worked at Google, they went to Harvard or Stanford and so on, Oxford, and like very impressive people. And of course, that's not me in any way. All of those things are not me at all. I came in through LinkedIn because the guy who hired me, we used to work together at Salesforce, and he saw what a great talent I was and how good I was at my job and how much I worked hard for it. So I came in through my connections. So, but when I sit in those rooms and we talk about our backgrounds and so on, I was just like, I remember the first like couple of months, I was deeply uncomfortable with it. Just like I didn't feel like I belonged at all, you know? And then I learned over time, like, I'm just going to lean into it. You know, I'm just going to sit in the discomfort. I'm going to say who I am. I shouldn't hide it. I shouldn't be ashamed of it in any way. It doesn't serve them. It doesn't serve me. And maybe they can learn something from it too. But it wasn't easy. It was really, there's some very vivid memories of just like where I felt very much like I didn't belong, where I felt like an imposter, where I felt like if they found out about my background, they're just going to be like, you shouldn't be in this room. You should go, you know, it's like horrible feelings. Right. But now I'm also like, again, like you said, when in your intro, and I don't take it for granted, but I've worked at some pretty iconic companies. I'm like, I think I can hang with the best of them at this point in time. I still am ambitious, and I still feel like internally, I still feel like I have way more to learn, but I also know my resume looks like I can hang with the best of them. So I just like, if you can't see that, that's on you.
I love that. Yes, I love that. That's, and I think to your point around it being flippant, I think there are times where we need to be that direct. We actually need to get to the point where you just don't care. You need to build up that muscle and that resilience where it's like, it's not about them, it's about you. In the sense of what you've gone through has got you to where you are. And the fact you're in those rooms with those people, you actually should be there in the first place. So learning that, I think that's such a great piece of advice, actually. And with those various names that I mentioned earlier on, I'm curious, how do you look at, how do you define success?
That's a good question. It's changed over the years, if I'm honest about it. I think when I was in my 20s, maybe even like early 30s, I was chasing more the status, the titles, the money, you know, like the perception of success. Let's put it that way. It's probably a better way of putting it. And it's not like I don't care anymore. I think it would be a lie. And I hate like being lying to people around this. Like, it's not that I don't care, but I care less about it. Now that my definition says, do I enjoy what I do every day? Do I feel like I'm learning and growing and developing to become a better version of myself? Either my leadership, my skills, my humanity, is that progressing in a way that I think is inspiring both to myself, but also for the people around me? It's not, so one of the things that when I'm trying to coach people and help them out, is say, you know, when you're thinking about your dream job, there's probably 15 to 20 factors that will go into choosing this job. It could be anything from pay to company, to culture, to boss, to commute, to title, to all these, your equity, all these different things, lots of things are going on. And so to say that titles don't matter and pay don't matter, I think is also, of course it matters, right? And it matters, especially where you are in your career, but it also should not be the most important thing. I said, if a title is important to you or your pay is important, of course it should be, because it projects certain things and it allows you to live in a certain way. But I also think if that's the number one thing you're chasing, or the number two or three, then you're probably not oriented around becoming the best version of yourself. So for me, of all those things, if I took that list of 10, 15, 20 things, the things that matter really mostly to me now is purpose. Meaning, am I fighting for something? Am I doing something that I feel like is worth doing? And that could be the big macro thing, like, do I believe in the company mission and what we're doing? Yes. But it can even be a small thing, like, do I believe in this team project that we're working on that is really inspiring, that I think is going to move the needle? It could be a big thing or a small thing. It doesn't have to always be this huge thing. But do I believe in what I'm working for, this purpose? That's the first thing. The second thing is the impact. It's very clear to me that impact matters a lot. And what I mean is, are you actually making a difference? People start losing motivation, including me, when you feel like I'm just not moving the ball forward in any meaningful way. And I hate getting to those Friday nights when I'm with my friends and they ask, you know, how's your week? You know, and I'm like, oh, so busy. I work my ass off. And then I think about, but I don't really know if I achieved anything worth achieving. It was just fighting fires. I was answering emails, Teams messages, Slack messages, jumping on meetings, like, but I didn't actually do anything meaningful. So I'm really like, impact is super important. Like, can I make a difference? So even when I get asked to be on an advisory board or board member or a keynote speaker, I'm like, is it going to make, what difference is it going to make? I don't want to just be there because I'm a good name. Hey, look at Robin. He worked at Salesforce and LinkedIn and these companies. What difference can I make by me being there? So impact matters a lot to me. And then the third thing is people. I really try to work with people who are amazing human beings, who laugh together, fight together, support each other, you know, who don't have a political bone in their body, who's not in it for themselves, who thinks about we over me, who's really all about like the team spirit. I think a lot about this phrase that I learned early on in my career that I've always loved, esprit de corps. It comes from French. It's a French phrase. It just basically means this feeling of pride in being part of something bigger than yourself. And I think that's super, super powerful. And I think about that a lot, like this thing that we have together collectively, does that make us proud to be a part of this? Is there honor in this together? Is there integrity in this together? So for me, the three most important things are purpose, impact, and people. But that's not to say that, again, to be clear, like a lot of other things matter, of course, as well. Pay and title and the office environment and all these things, they matter, but they just don't matter the most. Like you can live with that being less than optimal if the first three are top-notch. But if the first three are not top-notch, then you'll suffer in everything else anyway, right?
I think those are one words of experience that you've developed over the years that's important to listen to. But also, even when you look at, I think for the first time ever, recent studies have shown that, I think it's, I hate the term work-life balance, I use harmony, but work-life balance has surpassed money as the number one motivator for people, which has never happened before. So even there's so many different things when you think about purpose, again, that's, I think that was like third, and that's also starting to creep up where people are a lot more important, where it's around, especially with AI rising, purpose become more and more important for people. So there's so many things of what you just said right now, those three points, that the stats are there, that showcasing that's what people are leaning into. So it's important to have that front of mind, to be like, okay, yeah, you need money to survive. Yes, it's good to have the titles and the position, which comes with a lot of responsibility that you alluded to, but actually don't keep the main thing, which is all those different elements of stuff as well.
I'm very conflicted around the words work-life balance and even work-life harmony, right? It's like, and the reason why I like it, I like the idea of being in balance and the idea of people having joy and happiness and work and life is kind of equal measure. I get the vision of it. What frustrates me about it is it makes it sound like you should always have that. And I think there are seasons of life when you don't have that. Like, of course, if you just have a new kid, when I just had my son, only have one kid, yeah, the idea of me working 24/7, like I also wanted to be a good dad, right? So my life had to take up a little bit more of that balance. But the idea that it's always going to be perfectly balanced, I think it's completely, sends a false narrative to a new generation. I see this oftentimes, I spoke to a group of 20-year-olds and they're like, oh, I don't really want to work that hard. I just want to make a good pay. But then they all want to be like leading companies and they want to like be VPs and executive. I'm like, well, these two things don't matter. At some point, if you want to grow and succeed, you got to actually work hard and lean into it. And that means going above and beyond of what is expected of you. You can't do it all the time. You'll burn out if you try to do that all the time. But at some point, you actually have to lean into going above and beyond, right?
that's what I shy away from, saying balance, and I lean more into the harmony. Because for me, it's like, it's integration, where it's the ebb and flow, where there are things happening in your personal life where you need to prioritize them, where things happening at work, you need to prioritize that. But you're always in and out, you're integrating those two worlds together, trying to get that balance, it's impossible. And if you're chasing that, you're going to chase something that you can't exist, and therefore you're never going to be in balance. You're never going to be happy or fulfilled.
So, I can nearly guarantee it'll just lead to one thing, you feeling shitty about yourself all the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know? Because then you're like, oh shit, I'm neglecting my family if you lean too much into work. And vice versa, if you're just like focusing on family and you're like, oh, my work is suffering. Just go with the seasons of life, and there will be seasons for everything. There's times when you lean into work and there's times when you lean into your private life and you're recovering and so on. Just like you do if you're trying to train for something. Like if you're trying to train to have an amazing upper body and you go to the gym, going to the gym every day is not going to help you. It's very much around train, recover. You got to figure out that rhythm for you, right? Work, life is like that. You can't go hard all the time. It doesn't work. It doesn't help.
And I am curious, from all the books you've read and the experiences that you've had, what's one piece of advice that you know now that you wish you embraced earlier in your career?
I would say this idea of being your authentic self, I think it's just something that I think I would have wished I embraced. I think I spent too much time worrying about what other people thought about me, if I'm honest about it, you know? And I don't think people see it now. They like to see the modern version of Robin Daniels. I'm like, oh, I usually show up as myself. But I spent a lot of years, I think, trying to hide that or worry about it and so on. And I think I just kind of, I read a couple of books around this, more like in the self-help-ish realm, I would say. From Tony Robbins, Deepak Chopra, those kind of people around, like just learning to like live within your truth in some ways, to just be yourself. And so I've just kind of embraced that. But I really wish that I hadn't spent so much time and energy worrying about what other people thought about me, because it was pretty, I wouldn't say debilitating. I mean, I still managed to perform, I think, fairly well, but it was not positive or healthy, I don't think, in any way. Like just thinking about that too much, worrying about it. especially when you start realizing that everyone's is a little bit screwed up, right?
That's the truth.
It is the truth.
Everyone's got their own issues, just looks different.
They do. They really do. I know. I mean, tell me one person you know in your life that's a perfect human being. I bet you can't find a single person, right? Everyone has their issues.
And so you don't want to be around someone who's perfect either, because it just makes you feel absolutely exactly. Rubbish.
Totally.
So,
true.
I'm going to end with one question I always ask every guest, because I mean, there's so many angles to this conversation that I've enjoyed so much. And you're the perfect person to ask this too, actually. How do you define leadership?
Leadership is showing up with courage and conviction, making it not about you, but about the purpose of the greater team, like what you're trying to achieve together. Leadership is being completely selfless in many ways, right? Where you're always looking out for the best of what's for the team, and even more importantly, for the organization, the company. Like the moment you start optimizing for an individual or even for your team, you're going to start not succeeding as well. It's really about what is in the best interest of all of us collectively doing. I mean, all a company is just a collection of people trying to do great things together, trying to solve challenges. Sometimes those challenges are small, and sometimes those are really big and existential. And leadership is about showing up and making sure that everyone's focused on the most important things every single day in a way that doesn't make it about a person or a team or yourself, but makes it about the greater mission of what you're trying to do. And you do that with compassion and with empathy and understanding of leaning into what makes us each special and unique. That is what leadership is all about. It's not about trying to make everyone conform or fearful or nervous. It's about giving that certainty we talked about as much as you can, even with imperfect data, and then showing up and fighting like crazy to support you. Here's what I always tell my team, and I feel like every leader should say this. I say to my team, if you like what you do and you show up every day and you give it your all, my job is to fight for you every single day. I'll try to give you the resources and support and the courage and the knowledge and the skills that you need to be successful. That's my commitment to you. If you show up every day and you give it your all, and you like what you do, and you're a net positive to the people around you, that's my commitment to you. What I can't commit to is that your job will always stay the same, the team will always stay the same, that our mission is always going to stay the same, because we are a company in change and growth and transformation. And that's going to change over time. The way our company is going to look, the way our team is going to look a year from now, 2 years, it's going to be wildly different. So if you expect your job to always be the same, your role to always be the same, the team to always, maybe you should go somewhere else, because I cannot promise you that. But I can promise you I will fight like hell for you every single day if you show up and you give it your all every day. Then my job is to make sure that you have the environment where you can succeed and become the best version of yourself.
That's powerful. And I used to lead work in corporates, to ask them, my team, the question of what is it I can do to help you grow? What is it that can help create the best environment for you to thrive? Whatever that looked like for some people, whether it's promotions, it was more money. For some people, it just wanted to stay the same. But every single time it was around, well, can you also shield us from the political
ecosystem?
And I was like, yeah, I got you. Yep. So having those kind of conversations, but the way you just broke that down, honestly, I was like, I should just take that and just send that out to so many organizations. Because this is what it talks about when how do you have leaders who really show up for their teams and their people? This is what people actually want. So
it's one of those things. I had somebody at my last company, Matterport, who said to me after I'd left, and they'd also left the company, said, I didn't realize how much pressure you were absorbing. There was somebody who worked for me. And this is kind of part of the art of leadership. Sometimes you apply pressure and sometimes you absorb pressure, right? And sometimes the pressure is so immense and you're like, my job is to absorb it and not put it on my team, because they're just going to swirl and they're going to be defocused and not be able to perform. And other times you have to figure out, how do I pressure my team to actually focus or get more things done that they don't even know that they maybe should be doing, right? So that's why leadership is really hard, because you have to know when to absorb it and when to kind of apply that pressure.
Okay. And my last question then, how do you see things changing, especially as AI becomes more and more prominent in works? So how do you think things growing or things changing with teams and companies and organizations, especially like what you're doing at Zenia with the AI?
Yeah, I would say it this way. I think AI is going to disrupt everything to do with hard skills, but it's not going to disrupt everything to do with soft skills. Maybe one day, but I think we're very far from that day. So that, what does that mean for you in practice? I mean, it's like when I also think about the feedback or coaching I give to people who work with me or for me, it's usually like 90% of it's like on the softer skills. The way you collaborated here, the way you communicated with this person, the way you showed up, the way you phrased this thing, usually in the softer skills anyway. So lean into really learning that soft skills. Now, having said that, I also think in this age where everything's moving so fast, you got to show up with a kind of like a beginner's mindset, you know, very much of like, be willing to try new things. The idea that your job is going to stay the same, I think is very dangerous. It's moving so fast. So if you combine the focus on soft skills, the focus on being able to have an open mindset, a learner's mindset, a beginner's mindset, and then taking the initiative, not waiting to be told what to do, but taking the initiative to go and figure it out, I think you'll do fine. But the people who refuse that change is going to happen, who stay thinking that their hard skills are going to get them through. Because again, when I think about all the people who usually gotten promoted around me, some of it's because of their hard skills, because they're really freaking good at what they do. But a lot of times because they're soft skills, that's usually how you ascend to leadership. So lean into that. So the people who refuse to think that their job is not going to change or their skills will stay the same, they're there for a rude awakening, I think. So you have to lean into it.
Yeah. I talk a lot about intentional leadership. And I say there are four main things around that make great leaders. Someone who can lead with clarity, courage, conviction, and authenticity. And listen to this conversation for me. This has been a masterclass in all four, where you've just ticked every single box in the way that you just shared your journey, your story, and how you show up for yourself first, and then how you then, that flows into how you show up for other people in your ecosystem, in your teams, and around you as well. So just thank you. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing your journey. Like, I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation on so many levels.
Me too, Shop. I hope we do this again, honestly.
That'd be good. That'd be amazing.
You've asked some questions that I've never been asked before, and really made me, I think deeply. And I feel like I don't really have the perfect answer, but that's okay. That's part of it. I'm not perfect.
Perfect out here. We're being real and authentic, and that's what I love about
it. Exactly.
This is Everyday Leadership. We'll see you all next week.
This podcast is sponsored by Mindset Shift, a leadership development company focused on helping you lead from the inside out, not from the outside in. We work one-on-one with senior leaders in organizations. We work directly with HR and other parts of organizations to help you create an authentic culture where your words and your values and your actions on the line. We help you to navigate the complexity and the chaos that you'll experience day in and day out. And we have a couple of openings for the one-to-one coaching this year, but that's something that you're interested in. If you want to work with a coach who can help you navigate this year to ensure that you're intentional to take your leadership skills personally and professionally to the next level, send me an email at hello@mindsetshift.co.uk or just go to website www.mindsetshift.co.uk.